Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke, and for the last 2 weeks, I've been riding roller coasters at Universal Studios in Orlando, where they're currently doing Halloween Horror Nights. But the scariest part of my holiday was actually at Tony Roma's restaurant, when I realized I couldn't fast-forward Seth Rollins promos, Big Show matches, or Stephanie McMahon giving champions verbal vasectomies.
I'm Carl Jones, and when I look back wistfully on the autumn of 1997, I think about a voice much deeper than it used to be, a lot more acne, and hair where there wasn't hair before. But enough about the decline of Missy Hyatt, let's get back to the Monday Night Wars.
I'm G. John Chase, and I've any of you been following the news on WWE 2K16? They haven't included the Four Horsewomen. This is absolutely ridiculous. I will not buy this game no matter what you do. What was that? Arn Anderson's in the game. Touché, 2K. Touché.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke. You can follow me on Twitter at WrestlingProfit, where you may comment on previous shows, give ideas for future shows, and join in pertinent wrestling conversations, such as has Paige had a boob job? I think yes.
This is the panel for the 56th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us break down the third quarter of 1997 in the Monday Night War. Next. Welcome to the 56th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke, alongside G. John Chase.
Who the hell are you guys?
Carl Jones.
I think I've been here before. I think.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Sup, bitches, you know who I am.
And after a three-week absence with me being in sunny Florida, we are returning here today for the latest installment of the Monday Night War timeline that we've been doing over the course of the last year or so. Today we're going to be tackling the third quarter of 1997, covering from July to the end of September. So much to talk about. As always, we have notes from the Wrestling Observer newsletters of the time, so tip of the cap to Dave Meltzer for some of the notes we're going to read on today's show. Before we get into the thick of this, though, a couple of little bit of housekeeping tips here. Obviously, for those of you who are listening for the first time, if you're not, whatever, squaredcirclegazette.com is the place for all the archives where you can listen to the previous episodes of our Monday Night War Timeline series. And also, you can now, in fact, like us on Facebook, which you should do, at facebook.com/scgradio. It's going to be a fun little device, I feel, to centralise all the feedback. Obviously, you, our fantastic loyal listeners, provide every single week, and we're looking forward to doing it again in the future. SCG Radio. You can find us. All one word. So with that said, moving ahead to the Monday Night War timeline. So many notes, so many different things to discuss. We're going to start first with a couple of housekeeping tips when it comes to things that was referenced in the previous installment. We mentioned the big bombshell in the last episode of the timeline was Mike Tyson was in Las Vegas at Nitro, ready, willing, and able to do an angle on Nitro, but didn't happen. Did not happen. It has been confirmed, however, in the following Wrestling Observer newsletters, that two of the things that we speculated on in the last show were true. Mike Tyson was, in fact, supposed to do a cameo in an NWO t-shirt. That was his whole role. And it was not Eric Bischoff who made the call to pull it. It was Turner Broadcasting that didn't want the Tyson Association because, obviously, 2 days earlier he'd bitten Holyfield's ear off and they didn't see what it could have been, obviously, and they decided to pass on that. Another thing as well, obviously, Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart had their little cat fight in the previous month, and Shawn had taken more time off for a knee and neck injury that apparently had flared up as Bret Hart pounded on him. It says here in the Observer that Shawn Michaels has in fact had his first meeting with the WWF in Stamford on July the 3rd and will be on Raw in 2 weeks, probably not wrestling. So Shawn is back in the fold. And finally, the much talked about ECW-WWF relationship appears to be very close to falling apart, as the ECW match that was planned has been pulled from the SummerSlam pay-per-view. In addition to RVD getting heat, which we mentioned on the previous installment, WWF sources said that Heyman agreed to co-host Shotgun Saturday Night, but Heyman claimed he was never asked to do the show, only that they sent him a plane ticket to the tapings and indicated they had a surprise for him. WWF officials were doubly frustrated, claiming that Heyman had never called the building to say he wasn't going to be there, but only left a message on Bruce Pritchard's answering machine at home, knowing full well Pritchard was in Iowa at the tapings at the time. So that's an interesting little note there, because obviously the common belief is that obviously RVD fucked this whole thing up when it comes to ECW-WWF involvement. That's quite the big deal at the time. Paul Heyman, supposed to be commentator for Shotgun Saturday Night alongside Jim Ross, and decides to skip out on that.
Not completely dead though, is it? Because Lawler and Fast Tommy Dreamer still scheduled to
wrestle.
Indeed. And there are talks throughout this period of time that we're going to talk about today where there are rumblings that ECW is going to have an angle at the Madison Square Garden show in September, but it never comes to pass. So we'll move on here to the first show of this period of time, and obviously it's a big one. July 6th, the WWF Canadian Stampede Show. 12,151 fans in the building, and 0.59 buy rate for 165,000 buys. Just thoughts around the table on this show and the impact it had on us as fans at the time, because this is sensational stuff. I love this show.
I think it's an absolutely phenomenal show. I think I said on a previous podcast that I described it as arguably the greatest B pay-per-view the company's ever done. You know, that it's a real hot crowd, obviously being back in Canada for the Hearts. A fantastic main event, a fun opener with Mankind and Triple H, Taka Michinoku stealing a job that was never designed to be his as well.
from the great Sasuke.
But all around, just a really fun show in the ring in front of a hot crowd. And Steve Austin, I know I wax lyrical about him, but anyone who hasn't seen this, and I dare say you all listening probably have, but if you haven't, just go back and watch the show. Watch Steve Austin at the end flipping off the fans with his hands cuffed behind his back. It's absolutely phenomenal.
It's glorious. And I remember the first time I ever saw this show, a good friend of mine, Jason Perks, he taped it for us, and obviously he taped it and watched it himself. So when I press play on the tape, the first thing I see is Austin being carried out by the cops, giving the fans the finger, and I'm like, what the fuck is this? Like, this is so completely, you know, completely disparate from what I've been seeing as a wrestling fan around that period of time. So awesome show, so many good things to say about it. Just the atmosphere for the Hearts is just through the roof.
Yeah, I think you downplayed it a bit there, Carl. I mean, this crowd is white hot.
They
it's
are molten. There's that great shot early in the match where Brett's beating up Austin in the corner and the camera's shaking and the crowd's going nuts, and it just looks like the whole building's rumbling. It's just phenomenal.
In personal opinion, I think there's other B shows that I like probably more, but I can understand why this one's so highly regarded by people and by Carl when he mentioned it. But for me, it's whilst the undercard is absolutely solid, it is all about that main event. The Hart Foundation anyway is fantastic, just as a complete unit, and the talent that's involved in it, and Neidhart. And it's
who came out to Alundra Blaze's old music, yeah, just for reference.
Yeah. Well, they're treated like fucking like the Avengers, for Christ's sake, in Canada. Yeah, I absolutely agree with Carl on Austin's performance. It's during the mix of this, you know, the United States Canada kind of divide that they're deliberately playing into now. If you look in the faces of Shamrock and Goldust and the Road Warriors, they at least look like they don't know what to do. And I'm not talking about like what to do within the match. They know what they got to do there, but they don't know how to react to the audience because the audience is hostile to them. And the great thing which puts Austin apart from everyone on that side of the team, and there's a lot of experience on that team, is that Austin knows what to do. He knows what to do in every situation. He knows that he can flip him off, he can be an asshole, he can actually be the heel.
Attack Stu,
and get booed out of the building, but knows back at home the Americans are fucking cheering him like he's a god. And he knows that. The other four, they look confused and they don't know, like, they're just standing there. They're not even acting like baby faces, not acting like heels either. They're just standing there like mute. It's all Austin carrying that side of the team.
All Austin.
He just controls that match. And that's why, like, his performance, as Carl states, is the best of the night. It's the performance you remember.
He's a man possessed. And it's like, it's like he's been waiting for this focus his whole career, and
every week, man, he's just fighting this.
We're probably gonna say this after every week. He's a man possessed, and he's just more and more focused, and he's goddamn, he's just the best.
Just in terms of how Austin plays the role, just you can't really say any more clear than the way he just walks in, gets on the second rope, and gives the crowd the finger. It's just that simple. Notes from the Observer: the amount of media publicity was unprecedented in local wrestling annals for this show. There were stories in the newspaper every day, numerous autograph sessions, including one for Owen, Brett, and Davey, which drew an estimated 8,000 people. Moving along now to the next night, however, July 7th on Nitro, a great television show, says Meltzer, mainly for the booking. It's Hennig's first promo after he debuted the previous week, saying he's a free agent going to the highest bidder. Ric Flair comes out acting like he's going to be a horseman in the future, but it's yet to be determined where Hennig's future lies. La Parca pins Randy Savage with a diamond cut in the middle of the ring and obviously unmasks to reveal DDP. Ric Flair did an interview with a mannequin saying that Roddy Piper was just another stiff he's carried and made like 200 other guys, which of course leads to Piper coming out, ripping the clothes off, doing the classic angle before the horsemen make the save. The show ends with a Hogan interview and fans pelting him with garbage. Luger and the Giant come out and Luger racks Eric Bischoff while the Giant chokeslams Vincent and Bagwell while Hogan runs off. So that's the lay of the land. We're setting up here for Bash at the Beach that following Sunday, where it's going to be Hogan and Rodman against Luger and the Giant. So a lot of focus on that. Over on Raw, we're in Edmonton. This is one where Brett's wearing the Oilers jersey. He does a long babyface interview at the start of the show that was really good. They play the Canadian national anthem, and Austin comes in and hits Brett with a steel chair while the song's playing, which is just fucking fantastic. A great Takasasuke rematch, which is the best match on either show. Paul Bearer does a long interview talking about Kane, saying he's badly disfigured. When they went back to the crowd after the interview, you could see the disbelief in their faces, says Dave Meltzer. This is also the show where Steve Austin is looking for the partner, and Mankind gets the stunner to set up for next week, where he and another partner will be going against Owen and Davey Boy. So a lot of things set up here on these two episodes. Nitro does a 3.4 to Raw's 2.5, which is pretty much perfectly in line with where things have been for the last little while. Sid now has a sciatic nerve problem, and his left leg has been going numb.
He's got more problems than that.
Likely stemming from the auto accident. They are hopeful he'll be at SummerSlam to wrestle Vader, which is on the books, but that match hasn't been publicly announced because there's no definitive word. Sid was one of the real stars of the last quarter on this show. There's fucking many reasons why he can't do anything.
I thought you were going to say the match hasn't been announced because there's no public interest.
We move to that Sunday, WCW's time to hit pay-per-view. It's the Bash at the Beach. 7,851 fans sell out the building in Daytona, a 0.89 buy rate for 245,000 buy. So beating the Canadian Stampede show quite handily. Obviously, it's Rodman and Hogan, so this match gets a lot of play. CNN, ESPN, a lot of television sports show highlight reels this makes. There's a lot of stories in several newspapers. Rodman, the Worm, gets treated like he's the second coming to Luthez in the early stages of this match.
Oh, the arm drag and the leapfrog.
Yeah, flashes of brilliance, which is the classic line that made the Death of WCW book. But Luger wins clean here. He looks really good. He beats Hogan clean with a rack. He gets Rodman in the rack, gets Savage in the rack. It does speak to the frankly preposterous moment where Kevin Nash is dressed as Sting and attacks the Giant, and the announcers can't tell who it is, even though he's 7 foot tall and he's climbing over the top rope to get in the ring.
There's not really much I can say about that with Nash and Sting, you know, it speaks for itself. But it's interesting that this was the start of a period where, at least for a couple of months, Luger was given quite a bit of impetus. Obviously, we'd seen it the Uncensored pay-per-view, where he'd had the sort of Herculean effort, if you will, in the comeback against the NWO in that that strange concoction of a match where he just fell short. Yeah. And it's sort of gone a bit quiet, but we're seeing that brought more to the fore again now, and obviously it will play out in the weeks ahead. Just as a side note there, obviously, as you say, you mentioned it in the ratings, it's still, the trend is still clear with WCW far ahead, and the pay-per-view speaks volumes as well. Even as much as we talk about how great Austin was and how it's a hot crowd, you know, you look at the numbers and the numbers speak for themselves. I just always find it interesting. It's one of those little things that sort of nags at me a bit whenever we look back on this period in time. The attendance for some of these WCW pay-per-views, I always find it a bit strange. Maybe it's a sort of symptomatic of their lack of planning in many respects.
Oh, it totally is.
That they always booked these smaller buildings for their pay-per-views.
Yeah.
And obviously, they got away with it back then because they'd have, you know, Nitros at the Georgia Dome and what have you. But I always just find it strange that lack of sort of clear planning. You could imagine if this was Vince in his pomp and he's got all that publicity and he's got, you know, someone like Rodman or sort of someone of that, who had that sort of credibility at the time that Rodman had been on a successful Chicago Bulls team, that wouldn't have happened in an arena in Daytona that holds just under 10,000.
Kurt Hennig makes his first appearance on the show and shows up looking heavy and is slow and unimpressive, teaming with DDP against Savage and Scott Hall. Hennig walks out on page, so there's seeds here of Hennig possibly being a heel. Made a major mistake here on TV, the final TV, because DDP teased that the partner was going to be Sting, his mystery partner. He's saying that he had a mystery partner and looked up to the ceiling to see that it was going to be Sting. So when Kurt Hennig walks on out, it's not quite the impact that people were hoping for. So the match is kind of flat. Benoit beats Kevin Sullivan in a retirement match. And Roddy Piper beats Ric Flair here as well. Moving along here, the belief at press time, this is a big note going forward, is that Raw in September will switch from being a live show weekly to taping two shows every other week, since going live weekly has quadrupled expenses of doing the show without any significant movement in the ratings. WCW is also discussing minor changes for Nitro to possibly counter the unopposed 10 to 11pm second hour of Raw, particularly after the success the WWF had during that hour for an experiment on July 14th. This is quite an interesting note here, because this affects the business going forward. Obviously, we mentioned in the previous quarter, Raw is changing time slots from 8 to 10 to 9 to 11 starting in August. On July 14th, the experiment that we're talking about there, the WWF after Raw in that 10 to 11pm hour, aired highlights of SummerSlam shows dating back to 1988. The show, which in advertising was built around the biggest names in wrestling of the past decade, most of which are now in WCW,
yeah, I was gonna say.
With Hogan's name leading the advertising, did a shocking 3.75 rating and raised many questions about the potential for success in a later time slot. 3.75 is bigger than any Raw has been for a long, long time. So that leads to a lot of focus on the fact that 10 to 11 may actually be something that wrestling fans can gravitate to. For Raw and Nitro that night, however, the Nitro girls debut over on Nitro. Kurt Hennig does an interview calling Diamond Dallas Page the biggest mark in the dressing room. So more of that wonderful insider lingo. Funny note here, Bill Gold beat Hector Guerrero in a dark match. Gold is really green, but has good size, and people think he might have potential. So that's the first mention of the man that will become Bill Goldberg.
More on that later.
Over on Raw in San Antonio, this is the beautiful period where they're crisscrossing between Canada and the US every week. We're now in Sean's hometown of San Antonio, Texas. The Hart Foundation do a promo to start the show and announce the SummerSlam stipulations, including if any member of the Hart Foundation loses, Jim Neidhart will get his famous goatee shaved on live television the next night.
Oh, poor Jim. Why him?
Well, more on that later. There's a funny little thing there. Austin, Ken Shamrock, The Patriot, Sid, and Shawn Michaels all come out for a stare down on the ramp. This is the wonderful moment we've watched back, where Steve Austin's standing there, and there's inexplicably an American flag waving on the Titantron. It's just like the funniest visual of, like, Steve Austin in his black tights with a flag waving in the background, you know?
Well, it's the tease for who's going to be his partner, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And it's just so... I think it's still telling at this point. It's Austin's music's playing, yeah, the flag's in the background. But you got these guys like Sid, you know, who's been a big star in recent times, and then eventually, like, Sean on his return to his hometown walks out as one of the guys. Still Austin's music playing though. It's like very second fiddle. I said it on the last quarter. I think even back then they knew Austin was going to be their guy come Mania time, and I think this quarter really bears that out.
Michaels does an interview begging Vince to be a part of the SummerSlam show so that he can see The Undertaker beat Bret Hart and send him packing. Michaels didn't appear to even have a semblance of a knee injury, and apparently was doing cartwheels during the commercial break. So that's a classic Shawn right there. In the main event, Dude Love makes his debut to team with Steve Austin against Davey and Owen, and they win the tag team titles.
I kind of got obviously where they got it from, that it was from Mick's past when he was, you know, a mark for wrestling, but it's still a bit weird. He's already been a character for like, 2 years now, and a very serious kind of like a potentially deadly character going after The Undertaker, and then it's suddenly just, they like break that fourth wall down and just state like, oh, this is what the guy's really like. And he was a massive freaking mark for Jimmy Snuka back in the day, and he used to fucking paint a heart on his chest and jump off buildings. And it's just like, and it just kind of breeds this kind of like the Dude Love. I think if it just became that, then it would have been really weird, and I don't know quite how it would have worked. I find that this time period of late 97 through to I guess it's mid 98, where he's flipping back and forth between the three characters, quite interesting as to how he was able to keep popularity and keep people's interest in who he is when it apparently seems like the audience don't know who he is, or even Mick Foley himself.
Well, I think the key to that is, and you touched on it there, is the foreshadowing they'd already done in the Jim Ross sit down interviews. You know, they had made reference to his past history as Cactus Jack, so fans already had that link there, which is why I don't think the fans just shit on it like someone may do today if they just come out as a completely different character. They'd foreshadowed it. You got the more sort of human side, if you like, of the person themselves. So that's why they're able to associate and gravitate towards him regardless of which character he is. What I find interesting about that main event in particular, it's just nice the way they do it. We mentioned earlier in the show it's the tease of who the partner's going to be. And you still continue that tease before you see Foley, because you've got the boots in the background and on the Titantron. You just see them, just see the strut, and you don't see who it is. So it's nice foreshadowing in that sense even there.
Yeah, and as well, one other thing is the whole premise of the Jim Ross interviews from not so long before was that he, you know, he saw Dude Love as being the Shawn Michaels character.
Yeah.
He was replacing Shawn Michaels, so it's kind of a natural thing there for him to do, in a way. I don't think he was in the ring for long anyway.
No, he wasn't.
Pretty much still Austin doing it all, and then he just hits the stunner and Dude gets the pin, and then, you know, kind of gives him his grudging acknowledgement by throwing him the belt or whatever. So there's an element as well, because Mankind's this kind of wacky kind of loner, And when we showed that the dude loves stuff, it's like, you know, he's, there's kind of a similarity to Austin that, you know, he obviously loves wrestling, but he's an outsider, he's a loner. So there's almost like a kind of a natural symmetry where Austin doesn't have to be aligned with the guy because they're both, you know, loners and oddballs in their own way kind of thing.
Nitro for the show did a 3.6, the Raw's 2.6, so still a 4-point difference there. The total audience watching wrestling between the added hour of the special we mentioned previously and the Nitro replay record, which in itself did a 2.2 and almost beat Raw, would easily be the most for any Monday night in recent history. From backstage at Raw, Sid is believed to have suffered an anxiety attack at the show. Sid told friends he thought he was having a heart attack. WWF officials wanted to take him to hospital, but he refused to go and instead just went back to his hotel room. They never showed a close-up of him on TV and showed him in clothes because the auto accident injuries are legit as opposed to the questionable nature of his previous injuries, and he's dropped a lot of weight and no longer has that Sid look. So, yeah, anxiety attack apparently. Apparently the WWF has gone to a Hollywood studio at great expense and had a mask made that looks like a real-life burn victim, to the point it isn't even supposed to look like a mask. Glenn Jacobs is the best bet for the Kane role now. So, thankfully, no Papa Shango, we are getting Glenn Jacobs.
Great.
Lots of thought in WCW, speaking of masks, to get Rey Mysterio to lose his mask between now and the end of the year. Supposedly, people realise they've blown it with Mysterio. He'll wrestle Conan now at Road Wild, so he only ended up having a month off to rest his knee after all, and didn't have the surgery, so the surgery's once again been put back.
How long has that been going? What is it, about 6 months now at this
stage? Oh yeah, easily, because it's the start of the year when he...
Whatever. Sure, Michaels has knee injuries, isn't he? He gets all this shit. Rey Mysterio is a little golden boy. Yes, it is.
In other news from this week, the In Your House concept has been dropped, effective immediately, and the WWF will go to monthly, nearly 3-hour long shows, all with a $30 price tag. The change will be effective with the September Ground Zero pay-per-view. And obviously this will have very big implications going forward because of the amount of money they can make, very, very different. WCW, to counter the change in the Raw schedule coming up that we mentioned previously, will implement a semi-regular series of 3-hour Monday Nitros called Nitro Plus, going from 8 to 11. The current idea is that Nitro Plus will take place once a month with little warning in advance to when it will happen. That's the plan. The plan is to have no plan. The first one will be August 4th, which not coincidentally is the first week that WWF's Raw will start in its new time slot.
Because when less is more, just think how much more will be.
Nitro is preempted for one day this next week due to a TNT mini-series, so Raw goes unopposed, and we're in Nova Scotia for this week's show, and Shawn Michaels comes out to a heel response the likes of which would make the Sheik proud. Michaels does a backflip off the top rope, landing on his feet with his knee not even wrapped. I guess it's an inside rip to show his buddies that his knee is fine and he's just screwing with everyone. He also gave the click sign on the air, seemed out of it, and his voice was so far gone he sounded like Brian Pillman. This is when he's he announces, yeah, I'm gonna be the special referee for SummerSlam. He's walking around with his. I should note as well, this whole quarter is the real horrible Shawn Michaels shorts and loafers face. Unspeakable.
Is that the little cycle shorts with the freaking tan line?
Not even. Okay. No, that comes later. Okay. We're talking about denim. We're talking about the fucking. I don't even know what to call them. They're like smart.
They're like sort of khaki shorts, yeah. And he's got like a collared t-shirt on.
Which he always takes off. And he's wearing these brown loafers, no socks. The fans chant faggot at him, shockingly enough. They also announced, obviously, that if Shawn showed any partiality to The Undertaker, he'd never be allowed to wrestle in the US again, which will lead to, obviously, the finish at SummerSlam. Brett comes out and has a pull-apart with Vince afterwards, which is quite interesting. A bit of a precursor of things to come.
Yeah, and just as something you'd see on TV, this notion of someone getting physical interaction with Vince is not something you ever saw before. The continuation of those hints that Vince is the one in charge as opposed to the man who we've all seen as just the commentator for years.
Still subtle, but more regularly over this bit and up until, well, you know, climax at the end.
Oh, yes. And the flag match main event, 6-man tag, which is just, God, it's so good. The crowd is so red hot. Pillman gets involved with the finish, the Hearts win. Yay, baby faces go over here in Canada. Raw unopposed is a 4.1. The rating will be the highest for a Raw show in more than 1 year and among the company's best television audiences for any show in several years. So there is interest in this company. The Canada-US thing is obviously picking up a lot of steam here. One day later, the July 22nd Nitro, features Raven ripping up a WCW contract that's handed to him by J.J. Dillon, so we're not really sure what Raven's role is going to be. He's just sitting in the crowd not talking so far. We have a Hall and Nash match against Flair and Benoit with Six interfering for a run-in DQ. Surprisingly, and Flair again is talking to Kurt Hennig, expecting him to take the fourth spot in the Horsemen. So again, this is a very slow burn. It's funny because in the last quarter we talked about how treading water. It's a holding pattern. That was the phrase that we used, and that's very much the case in this quarter. I'll give him a little bit more credit because as we go through here, there are a lot of threads that they are kind of consistent for the entire quarter. So, and this is one of them, the Flair Hennig stuff.
It is, but I recall that it was a long time, the tease of Henning and who he would align with. But when you mentioned it before, I can't remember it being this long. I'm surprised at just how long it was looking back.
So yeah, Nitro on a Tuesday does a 3.8. A big shock and very significant in showing people won't stick to viewing patterns and will seek out WCW. TBS is still after a show, and WCW realizes the company is doing well with the current situation and a major change would risk everything, so they are trying to find a way to avoid doing it. Oops.
Should have tried harder.
At a meeting with the wrestlers this week, Eric Bischoff specifically said he didn't want any bad words, vulgar or distasteful gestures on the television shows from now on. There were complaints from the higher-ups. Bischoff told the wrestlers to leave the dirty words and vulgar gestures to Vince McMahon, which he will gladly do as we go forward. But actually, yeah, that's quite interesting because this is the period where you start to see Scott Hall and Six crotch-chopping an awful lot. We move to the following week, July 28th on Nitro. The Hogan vs. Luger title match for next week is announced here. J.J. Dillon will also on that show offer Sting a contract to join WCW next week. So obviously there's a lot of teasing here for the first head-to-head in the new time slot. Zabisco and Eric Bischoff have a confrontation ending with a giant chokeslamming Bischoff to a huge bop. So good stuff here. A Scott Steiner and Randy Savage main event with an outsider's running and the giant doing a save. Over on Raw, Pittsburgh this week, 12,588 fans sell out the building. This is where Bret Hart gets the great line in about if you were going to give the United States of America an enema, you'd stick the hose in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Crush versus Farouk goes to a double disqualification when the gangs run in and Ahmed Johnson returns. Meltzer notes that he blew out his knee and somehow wound up even bigger. Go figure. And Shawn Michaels does colour commentary during a Bret Hart versus Patriot match, where Shawn was absolutely fucking outstanding on commentary. Just a completely obnoxious douchebag. The Patriot pins Bret with a schoolboy after a ref bump, and Shawn Michaels hitting the ring to attack Bret. So the Patriot going over Bret here. We haven't mentioned the Patriot much. He debuted a couple of weeks back. He seems so out of place for me during this entire period. Even with the nature of this angle, he just seems like baseless, colourless, stick this plastic man in amongst the energy.
Generally speaking, outside of this sort of this one moment and the sort of the brief build to Ground Zero that we'll probably reference later on, he's generally quite you know, the character's cold with the audience for the most part. And I suppose whilst I'm not a fan, and to your point, Liam, he is very much out of place, especially when you've got sort of the attitude, pardon the expression, and the grittiness of a character like Austin to then sort of throw in. Almost, you know, the character you'd have seen from the 1980s, the Americana with the mask and the flag waving. You know, it's almost Jim Duggan without the plank of wood. I will say this in defence of the Patriot, if I can.
Well, this will be your first.
Whilst I acknowledge he's cold with the audience, there was no build up to the debut of the Patriot,
was there?
Out,
there was nothing. We said with Steve Austin.
But no, even before that, didn't they debut him on a show in Canada? I believe they debuted him on the first show they debuted him on, I think, was that Edmonton Raw.
Yeah.
So, you know, when that's your starting point for the character, that's not going to do you any favours either, is it?
And just that stupid double fist pump in the air to get the crowd going. Fuck off, Dale.
And the thing is, even the American audience, in truth, has no connection to this person because the only other time he'd really wrestled with any sort of prominence in North America was a brief stint in WCW when he was teaming with Marcus Bagwell.
Your boy.
Martin. Don't ever call him my boy.
Stars and Stripes, Carl. Yeah. Come on.
They saw what was happening with this character pretty early on and ditched it as soon as they could.
Did that, I thought, didn't he tear his tricep or something?
He tore his tricep, yeah, and he was gone by the end of the year. The ratings, after last week's unopposed Raw, the ratings were the closest this week that they've been in a long time. Nitro is a 3.35 to Raw's 2.9, so they're actually cutting it pretty close. close now. Clearly, the US Canada angle is super hot, although compared to WCW, the promotion lacks depth. Speaking of depth in the WWF, Sid was officially fired this week by the WWF!
Yay.
Yes! At last! It's mind-boggling, says Meltzer, that a star of that magnitude...
What?
Yeah. In a wartime situation, would be fired. But WWF officials apparently felt they had no alternative, citing their inability to get any straight answers from him concerning his condition and when he'd be available. So long, Sid. Hit the bricks. We'll see you in about a year and a half when ECW fans go crazy for you for some reason. Jim Neidhart disappears this week as well. Before coming to the WWF... Oh, come on. He had signed an exclusive contract with the Universal Championship Wrestling Company, and the WWF wasn't aware of that. They wanted Neidhart to legally get out of the deal before they put him back in the mix, so the stipulation about Neidhart shaving his beard has been dropped, which I'm glad, after all these years, I finally know about, because I remember reading about that in PowerSlam, and watching that episode of Raw when they announce it, and then of course it never happens, even though Pillman and Owen both lose. So a real blow to the depth, Sid and Neidhart are both gone. The current plan is to add a pay-per-view show just for the United Kingdom on September 20th from the NEC Arena in Birmingham, with the plan being to headline it with Bret Hart versus Davey Boy Smith in a rematch from SummerSlam 92, which is a plan that didn't, of course, come to fruition. We'll talk about what did very soon.
Fucking great.
We move now to the second biggest show of the year for the WWF. It is indeed SummerSlam on August 3rd, a 0.8 buy rate for 225,000 buys, so very close to the Rodman number without the huge price tag. 20,213 people in the building, they're packed here in New Jersey. Bret Hart wins the WWF Championship for the fifth time in the biggest kayfabe news of the show, in the match that didn't make the cut for the top 20 SummerSlam matches of all time from this panel, but probably should have.
For no other reason, just for Bret's little shuffle when he wins the belt.
Oh, the loogie to Sean. The loogie to... It's like I said before, the match I'm not particularly thrilled about, but the finish is one of the best, I think, in company history. I love the finish. The slow-mo that you can do afterwards, and they did it on Raw for weeks, of Sean counting slowly while looking in Bret's eyes. Oh, it's fucking fantastic. Of course, the biggest news is the fact that Steve Austin gets temporarily paralysed in his match with Owen Hart on this show.
What's your thought on that whole kind of scenario? In terms of the actual pile driver itself, do you think that was just like a freak accident or negligence on Owen's part?
Well, it's total negligence. He dropped one on his fucking head and paralysed him. I don't think there's much question about it.
Tombstone.
So then...
with his head feet below his ass.
Considering... yeah, exactly. When you see it, it's absolutely blatant, but it's just like... What I want to get at really is just like what would you think the reason would have been for him to do something like that?
It was just a movie he wanted to do, I guess.
So do you think it was actually like intent to actually try and power?
No,
that
of course.
No, don't be absurd.
that's what I'm getting at. So, what did you think it was? Do you think it was just a freak accident or something? No, it was deliberate.
No, it wasn't deliberate. It was just when we say it's negligence, we don't mean with malicious intent. It was just. It was just performed poorly, and those were the consequences as a result. I don't think there's anything nefarious
in the shooter
at all.
It's
all because he wanted that T-shirt.
Is that Owen 316 shirt?
It's just always confused me as someone of Owen Hart's experience and caliber wrestler would make that sort of fuck up. Weird move to do.
He'd never done it before in the WWF.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just I don't know why Austin would have agreed to it as well.
Well, he didn't. He thought the big conversation was that Owen said, "I'm going to drop to my ass," and Austin said, "No, drop to your knees." Owen said, "No, I dropped to my ass," and Austin said, "Well, you need to drop to your knees." And then he dropped to his ass and paralysed him. So I never got an apology. Apparently,
My big critique there would be, why the hell are they allowing him to even do a tombstone pile driver anyway when it's Taker's finish
and he's in the main event?
Yeah. We know how big a blow this is potentially to the company, even though Austin goes on to play a prominent role on TV in the following period. The fact that they can't book him for any matches of any kind, obviously it's not great for him, and obviously at the time raises serious questions about his well-being going forward, which would obviously manifest itself in later years with his neck troubles and the spinal fusions and what have you.
Yeah, keep in mind, we mentioned on the last timeline that Steve Austin was given a diagnosis that he should probably retire before this even happened for severe neck erosion that we talked about.
Although to the company, losing Austin from an in-ring point was another blow, and the longevity of his career obviously took a hit from it. This period when he's off is the best thing that could have happened to him.
Yeah, totally.
Rather than being on TV defending the IC title and eventually dropping it, he's becomes more of the focus of the show without even wrestling, with the concept that he wants to wrestle and they won't let him, and what this momentum he gets from it, at a point when, with what's coming with Sean, obviously, the next night and going forward, he is the strongest face. With Taker's kind of, you know, Taker in that Taker role where he's, you know, top guy, but he's not really focused as, no, as a real character and driving the shows. It's all Austin without even wrestling. He really starts to skyrocket now in terms of face. I mean, they are going fucking crazy for him going forward.
Oh yeah.
Do you think Austin made the right play? Because it's just like, we know why he did it. We know why he did it, because he knew he was hot and he knew he had to go right now in order to become a big star. But at the same time, it was at the risk of his own life and his actual career, which did end, you know, too soon, in all fairness. So it's like, did he make the right decision, or should he have held off a little bit longer, tried to ride the wave of goodwill with the fans and so on, and actually have the next surgery then? What's your opinion? Do you think he made the right decision?
I think that's an interesting question to ask Steve Austin, actually. I think if someone ever gets a chance to ask Steve Austin that question, I think that'd be really interesting. At this point in your life, would you rather have waited the time or got the surgery earlier, and maybe, I don't know, it's interesting.
Because I don't see it being as a complete, like, you're probably going to answer it now, but I don't see it as quite black and white, as in, if he didn't do it now, he would have failed. I don't see it as like that. I see it like that. Even if he waited, I think he still would have become a big star. The battlefield would have been a bit different by the time he would be ready.
I would be the contrarian to that argument. I think he absolutely needed to stay with the company, stay in the lineup, not have the surgery at the time. Because as short-sighted as it may seem, it is a war. They're still losing. Vince, in his panicky nature, which we've seen in previous points in time, could easily just sour on the idea of Austin. It's not outside the realms of possibility, so I can completely understand why Austin did what he did. And if it's me, I probably do the same.
Badass.
Well, I've seen some things in my time. But in relation to what Liam said there, I think that might be a question for the Wrestling Prophet to ask.
You know, Carl, I was just about to say, I will ask Steve on Twitter.
I guess if he did hold off and actually take the next surgery, who was to say he would actually still have a job by the time he got back? I'm not talking about, like, them being interested in him. There might not have been a company by the time he did come back.
Well,
the way things
and there are some interesting financial things coming up that give some credence to that. So Steve Austin obviously goes to the emergency room at the Meadowlands Hospital and was released at 1 a.m. after having apparently suffered a stinger in his neck. Ahmed Johnson, speaking of injuries, recovering from a recent arthroscopic knee surgery, re-aggravates his injury in a post-match brawl with the DOA, and will be out once again until late September. So Ahmed, back on the shelf. Moving to Raw the next night, this is the new time slot, the first time, 9 till 11 here. The original plan for this episode of Raw was for Shawn Michaels to solidify his heel turn by costing Steve Austin and Dude Love the tag titles, which would go back to Owen and Davey Boy, but obviously Austin can't wrestle. So instead, Michaels solidified his turn, doing a total heel interview. I love this promo. This is the Shawn Michaels, "You're gonna put all this in my lap!" Again, wearing khakis and loafers. And it's just, it's fantastic, because this is, I don't give a damn about anybody. He's got so much pent-up rage in his face. And if I was a psychology student, I would love to have observed this at the time and just seen the fact that you're watching a guy melt down on television. Every single week, Shawn Michaels is doing a promo. It's so fascinating to watch. And again, to your earlier point, Kieran, when we're talking about references to Vince McMahon here, Shawn gets plenty of them in here on Vince being the guy running the show and how he's a Nimrod.
Sean's favourite new word for the quarter is Nimrod.
Yeah.
it's that deep-seated insecurity that he has. I mean, obviously stemming from what he thought the business is like with you know, being a smaller guy and so on and so forth. And it's kind of this weird thing where probably he was thinking, he was fighting a one-on-one battle with Brett for the number one spot, not kind of realising there's this other guy behind them who's going to be more popular than both of them combined.
See, I don't know. I don't know about that. Trust me.
You don't think he saw it?
Oh, I think he did.
They all saw it at this point.
I think that that's what this is. Yeah. I think this is Sean realising he's losing his grasp.
Well, it's two things. One, it could be maybe with the trouble with Brett and Sean, from a logistics point of view, if they're both heels, they're not going to cross paths as much, so maybe less headaches. But absolutely, the fact you've got Brett as a heel, you're turning Sean, it just, I mean, they knew Austin, and so it was a massive fucking blow. they wouldn't have done that if they hadn't had plans already. So
yeah, exactly.
And we've seen from Brett's documentary, you know, Wrestling with Shouts, he was acutely aware of the change in landscape at this point.
Yeah.
The ringside conversation between him and Patterson, where he's asking
Wrestling with Shadows, right?
Wrestling with Shadows, where he asks about if Sean's going to be a heel now, doesn't that mean he's going to take all my heat? So you know, they're all acutely aware of what's going on. It's very much posturing and positioning.
Also on Raw, Steve Austin hits Owen Hart with a slammy to cost him his match against Dude Love. Austin is not wrestling, of course. Ahmed Johnson is beaten down and kicked out of the Nation. Ahmed was only told 10 minutes before going through the curtain that they were turning him back babyface because they felt like they lost out on a top babyface by making him go heel. So, fuck it. This, to me, just killed Ahmed. Dead. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that he didn't get a reaction after this, but just the fact that he was such a strong babyface against the Nation and then joined them in shocking fashion and then got kicked out of the group, not even doing the Batista turn on them. It's they kicked him out for being shit and being injured all the time.
Well, I think he was a white man in a black man's body, I think was the line from the next week. Farouk's aware, not mine.
Yeah. But maybe I made that clear. However, on the other channel, it's the 100th episode of Nitro, 3 hours, August the 4th, Lex Luger beats Hulk Hogan clean with the torture rack to win the WCW Championship. I fucking love this.
That was, if I remember right, that was the fucking pop from that.
Oh my God.
Just, we were talking about like the pop of like the Canadian Stampede. Well, here's like another one.
This
really.
Is ridiculous. They are so, I love this episode of Nitro. It's like, this is one of the things where I watched this back to prepare for this podcast, the whole show, and it's just so sad. So I was like, look how much people care about this fucking WCW Championship, and look how much they do such a great job, even in the aftermath where they got like Heenan on commentary and Shivani's going nuts on commentary, talking about how big of a deal this is that they've wrested the championship back. They're wiping the NWO spray paint off the belt.
It's the baby faces are filing into the ring.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Dean Malenko gets no soul for a high five by Luke.
Well, they probably didn't see.
Yes.
High five down by your knee.
Yeah.
Is this, we mentioned before, the opportunity WCW have to make guys from underneath, and the guy who gets the big moment is Luger.
Yeah.
And it's...
But you know what, though? You say that, I don't know. When you watch this period of time, it is not... Luger is over. Long before this show actually happens, the crowd's with him completely. They're with him for months. They fucking got that torture act over so much. And like I said, like they had him beat Hogan clean on Nitro in 6 minutes. Yep. They had him beat Hogan clean at the Bash. They have him beaten clean here on television for everyone to see. He fucking racks Rodman, which got in all the... He was over.
I'm with you on that, but I'm just on the other lane of the road, I guess. But it's just, I don't think it's necessarily the wrong that it was like Luger to do it. Because then, like, as you said, you explained yourself, Luger was kind of over at that point. And you know, amazingly enough, he did get over at some points in his career. But they already knew what the end goal was with Sting.
Yeah.
So from this standpoint, I can get why they did it. As you said, it's the 100th episode. It's
3 hours, head-to-head with new time slot.
Head-to-head with new time slot. So a lot of things coming together here when he needed something big to happen. But at the same time, knowing what they actually know at the time, where they want to end up at Starrcade, do you think it was the right move for Hogan to lose the belt to someone else before he lost it to Sting? Do you think that was the right idea? Or maybe they should have just left that and then Sting's the first person to beat Hogan?
I'd say the Starrcade buy rate probably tells you that it was fine. So
I was going to say, history has shown us the way that played out. I can't envisage a situation in which the Starrcade buy rate does any better if Hogan... doesn't drop the belt for a very brief period. Whilst it is a very sort of short term manoeuvre, I think it does help to break that sort of booking malaise, and we saw it there with the constant run ins and things like that. So I think every once in a while you need to have something like that to just break the pattern.
This match, Luger versus Hogan, is a 5.2 quarter hour rating, so people were fucking into. Again, we mentioned it there being a knee jerk reaction, but they built Luger up for months and months as a guy who could have Hogan's number if he got him one on one. And they even, we mentioned the idea of the NWO doing the run in and Luger fights them all off, they don't touch him, so there's no DQ, and then he taps him out clean with a rack. It's just fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, there'd clearly been build for Luger, but when I say short term, I mean very much in the narrow confines of it being it's a Monday Nitro, we're going to do it now, as opposed to Road Wild in 3 weeks' time.
It's actually 1 week time.
It's even shorter than I remember.
He did it on the go home show for the pay per view. Who's going to buy their cow and they get the milk for free, right? That's the deal. That's the line. The Steiners also on this show introduced Ted DiBiase as their new manager. DiBiase had walked out on the NWO at Spring Stampede. Hall and Nash said the only reason the Steiners wanted him was so they had someone who could read the menus to them in restaurants.
Is that true?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what he said. I don't know if that's the real reason they wanted him. J.J. Dillon comes out with a contract for Sting to wrestle Kurt Hennig, but Sting rips up the contract when it's only for Kurt Hennig and leaves, and there's a lot of boos for Sting when he refuses to sign the WCW contract. I love this whole setup where you got Gene and Dillon in the ring. Dillon's trying to talk about how, look, I know, and again, they did a video package earlier in the show as well where they're showing the story of the betrayal of the trust that fucking over Sting, why he is the way he is, the attacks he's done, the journey of Sting up to this point, and he just looks so sad and morose through this entire segment. It's fantastic.
That sort of contrast, it's that juxtaposition of the short-termness of bringing the title change forward and having the match 6 days before the pay-per-view to the long-term build and the very clear plan that they've got for Sting, which they'd started teasing the previous week with the contracts.
We have a reply on Twitter, not from Steve Austin, but from Air Raid. Next week, can Old Man Jones 85 ask Kane? I'll pass this to you.
Why don't you fuck off? Duly noted.
Oh, what an interactive show.
It really is. Love it.
It's like Taboo Tuesday.
Yeah, so the results of the first experiment here for the 3-hour Nitro, the results are in, and it looks as though we're in for a lot of 3-hour Nitros. Nitro did a 4.3 rating to Raw's 2.7. For Raw and Nitro combined between 9 and 11, the total rating was 7.1 with an 11.8 share, meaning a total of over 5 million homes are tuned into wrestling. That share figure is phenomenal because it shows just how mainstream pro wrestling really is at this point. It's the first time the 5 million homes barrier had ever been broken when it comes to viewing pro wrestling at one time in the history of cable television. So, man, big night for WCW here. The WCW status of Steven Regal is questionable as he was involved in a major disturbance on an airplane coming to the United States from Japan, urinating on a flight attendant in first class, which caused the plane to make an emergency landing in Anchorage. A felony charge stemming from this could affect his working visa and cause him to be deported, which would cost him his job. Also, Six was fired for a short time this week.
What a day.
Eric Bischoff was under a lot of heat from the higher-ups for vulgarity standards. Six must have used some naughty words, and some of his gestures, the crotch chops, weren't met with the highest of approval. In a tag match with Flair and Hennig versus Norton and Bagwell, Six pulled Flair's tights down, and Bischoff claimed it was the straw that broke the camel's back. When he told Hall and Nash what happened, they were ready to quit, and an hour later, everything was fine. So, there you go. Six is fired, and then comes right back. According to Dr. James Andrews, who, after this, I'd like to see some of this guy's credentials, the most noted knee specialist in the country apparently, claims that from an exam this past week, Shawn Michaels' knee is so bad that virtually any doctor would suggest he retire from wrestling. He has serious arthritis in the knee, and his ACL is very close to going out.
Hero.
Steve Austin went in for an MRI on August 8th and was told by one of the leading neck specialists in the country that he should retire and that he'd be risking paralysis to continue. Since he's not going to retire, he's getting a second opinion. So that's the stats.
Well, he might go that back to that Dr. James Andrews.
He might, yeah, that's probably
the best. I do tell him he's all right.
We move now to Road Wild, August 10th. No money made at the gate. 0.65 buy for 183,000 buys. Dave Meltzer sums this up by saying one of the bad ones. The reasons why are a huge story. The setting was strike one, the backstage manoeuvring was strike two, and the result of that manoeuvring, the lame, hastily put together finishes up and down the show, was strike three. We mentioned some of this in the Hulk Hogan trial a few weeks ago, which you can go back and listen to at squaredcirclegazette.com, of course. The belief is that Hall and Nash went to Bischoff and told him they thought there were too many title changes and it was ruining the credibility of the belts, and got out of losing to the Steiner brothers after months and months of build.
They'd run him off the road, for Christ's sake.
They run him off the road. Just before the beginning of the show, the three title changes went to zero. There is one ultimate authority in WCW, says Meltzer, Hulk Hogan. When he showed up, zero title changes went back to one. It was decided that Hogan was going to win the belt with the show about to start, and nobody had figured out a finish to accomplish this. So they just did the fake Sting angle from the month before and had Scott Hall in the Sting mask, which the announcers sound like idiots trying to act like this was some kind of shock and it was actually Sting again. Luger, thanks for playing. Yeah. Hogan's got the belt again. Off we trot.
Few weeks, that was nice.
Six days.
Oh well.
they drop balloons on him.
No, no, of course it's an outdoor
he
arena.
Yeah.
Did he celebrate losing the title?
Nitro goes back to 2 hours this week. It's August 11th, and of course that's Hulk Hogan's birthday. So the NWO sings happy birthday to him, even though he's not there. Kurt Hennig said he'd team with Ric Flair at the Clash of the Champions, but had no obligations after that. Flair said he was mad that Hennig was talking to Eric Bischoff during this whole free agent storyline. Hennig refused to say that he'd align himself with the Horsemen. The main event of this show is Hennig versus Savage, with a DDP running on Kurt Hennig, but Randy Savage ends up laying out DDP with the elbow. So they're continuing the Savage-DDP feud. It's been kind of a consistent thing, and obviously Hennig's getting involved now as well. Over on Raw, August 11th, Shawn Michaels does another promo with the fans chanting, "Shawn is gay." which only ends up with Sean saying, "Ask your mom and your sister how gay Sean is."
Yeah.
Which is just fantastic. Farouk pins Chains in 3 minutes when Rocky Maivia, who hasn't been seen for a while, interferes and gives Chains the Uranagi and joins the Nation of Domination. So he has turned heel at last. And there's some good stuff coming from here if you didn't know
instantly
that, folks.
Instantly a massive... He's like he's always been a heel. This guy.
Oh yeah! 1 week later, yeah. They're booing about the build.
Oh god! Yeah,
He's got something. The main event is Shawn Michaels versus Mankind, which is actually a really cool match because you got like the brawling on the outside, a lot of action by the ringside table, the commentator's table. Shawn with the sweet flying elbow off the apron at one point. Really cool stuff here. Shawn wins after Rick Rude returns and hits Mankind with a chair. Rude was brought in as part of a working agreement with Paul Heyman. Rude appeared, and in exchange, Ross plugged the ECW pay-per-view show and the Lawler Dream Dreamer match several times on Raw, including the main event where Vince is like, "Okay, can we get back to talking about this now, please?" The original deal is for it to be a one-time thing, but it appeared they are going to form yet another group, which will probably be called The Click, with Michaels, Rude, Helmsley, and China. Undertaker came out at the end of the show, and Bear is on the video wall vowing that Kane is still coming. Ravishing Rick Rude returned to the company. This is another strange one, the insurance policy angle here. When Shawn Michaels found out that Rude was doing the bodyguard gimmick, he cried and complained because he didn't want Rick Rude and he wanted Helmsley to be his bodyguard. The imposing, posh aristocrat as the bodyguard. Rude will be with him for a little longer, but likely move on to other things. Rude has yet to sign a WWF contract, so in this climate, putting him on television carried some kind of risk, says Dave Meltzer. Mm.
More on that later.
More on that in the next timeline, yeah.
Sorry, hold on a sec. So just go back a bit. So he wanted Triple H to be the bodyguard.
Yes.
So he wanted the guy who has a woman as his bodyguard to be his bodyguard.
Yes.
Wrestling.
War loafers, what do you expect? For this show, Nitro does a 3.8 to Raw's 2.95, so we're kind of back to normal, although both sides have shown a noticeable increase in their average rating after last week.
Yeah, we're seeing this point, and Meltzer obviously referenced Meltzer earlier, and we're at that stage now where, whilst even in 96, the numbers they were doing could be considered good by cable standards, we are at that point now where wrestling's cool again, brain, and it's made the sort of the mainstream breakthrough. It's noticeable there, though, that even though Nitro have re-established the more significant lead after that week where the gap was closed a bit, we're seeing that point now where Raw is starting to border around that 3.0 mark, even with the competition.
If anything, says Meltzer, the message this rating sends to WCW based on this week and the big numbers the week before for the 3-hour show is that 3 hours looks to be the answer. It may not be the answer a lot of people want to hear.
It was the fucking question.
But you can't ignore the numbers in a ratings-driven business.
So who do we have to blame then for 3-hour shows?
Lex Luger.
Lex fucking Luger.
God, there you go.
Damn it.
He really can't catch a break.
He's
not my hero.
The fans demand it though. People wanted more.
Well, yeah, no, but you've got to look at the Turner organisation at this point. They're pushing for a show on TBS. They clearly want more wrestling because of its popularity at this stage. So it's only natural, having seen those numbers from the week before, it's not going to take much for them to say, "Oh, well, they're not ready to give us a show on TBS yet, but we can still milk this cash cow. Let's give them the extra hour."
Supply and demand, baby.
Yeah, and you know what, though? Customers used to demand asbestos in their ceilings for installation, and that kills you too. Just because you want something doesn't make it a good idea, folks.
Yeah.
They're very true, but who are we to judge when they are prisoners of the moment, and particularly when Bischoff only has so much sway?
Yeah.
You know, he can protest about the TBS show, We'll get to that at a later date. He can protest about burnout from a three-hour show, but if the Turner higher-ups want it, he's going to be given it regardless, and he's just got to figure out how to work with it.
Well, unfortunately, this kind of starts a bad precedent for WCW anyway, because I can't remember how long away it is, but like when we eventually get Thunder as well, it's just...
Before you say that, World Championship Wrestling is expected to officially announce shortly the addition of a second two-hour weekly live television show! Starting at 8 p.m. on Thursday nights with a kickoff date planned for January on TBS. It is believed that TBS offered $12 million a year for Thunder. Eric Bischoff was telling people he was going to resist doing the show unless it is specifically ordered by Ted Turner, but high-level internal meetings were held this week to work on putting it together. So, again, more is the theme, unfortunately, here.
Yeah, 5 hours a week from one company.
How do you like it? How do you like it? Some sort of a program which will culminate in Brett versus Shawn at WrestleMania was suggested to Brett, but was nixed by Brett this past week. So, although it is interesting, we talked about, you know, the plan for Austin, they're still thinking Brett and Shawn here, or at least they're mooting it, yeah. August 18th episode of Nitro, Gene Okerlund interviews Ric Flair and Kurt Hennig, and the fans cheered Flair while booing Kurt Hennig. Okerlund interviewed J.J. Dillon, and eventually Sting came out and grabbed a sign from the crowd indicating that what he wanted was actually a match with Hogan, although he still didn't speak. The heat for the tease of the Sting-Hogan match was absolutely incredible in the building. The main event of the show is Lex Luger and DDP versus Scott Hall and Kevin Nash with a running DQ finish.
Back to the holding pattern.
In terms of the finishes, although they are teasing dissension here with Luger and DDP moving forward into Fall Brawl, which is a quite interesting little thing that they were doing there for a brief period of time, very brief period. Over on Raw, Rocky Maivia does his promo explaining three simple words, die Rocky die. Pushed hard that it wasn't a racial deal, so even in this he gets a good reaction. The crowd's chanting Rocky sucks immediately.
Yeah, he pushes it wasn't a racial thing. Yeah, coming seconds after Farooq blatantly saying it is a racial thing.
Yeah, and then as soon as he says it's not a racist thing, he says, you know who is racist? DOA.
Yeah, because I always remember from his book, which I believe he wrote, I remember when he said, like, he asked for mic time, then he said, I want to ask for mic time because even though I'm joining the nation, he wants to be here. He wanted to stress the point, dude, that it wasn't racial.
Dude, don't fucking quote from Rock's book.
Yeah. Brian Pillman makes his indecent proposal to Goldust on the show because he's had to wrestle in a dress for the previous couple of weeks after losing to Goldust at SummerSlam. And what was a fucking horrible match, by the way. I love Brian Pillman, but that match is fucking dog ugly at SummerSlam. It's not good.
It's that stage where it was even before that, it's at that point where you wince watching him wrestle, don't you? Just imagine how difficult it is.
He tries to do his awesome rocket launch into the crotch on the top rope spot in his match with Goldust, but he can't take the impact on his ankle, so he just fucking ends up like landing face first on the ring apron. It's like, what the fuck are you doing, Brian? Marlena accepts the indecent proposal, which was not done particularly well in the slightest.
It's a strange one, isn't it, in the sense of it. I remember that the weeks of build up to the dress and Goldust coming out and costing Pillman matches. I think there was a strange one where I actually just punched the baby face for a DQ.
Jesse James.
Just punched Jesse James for the DQ finish, so Pillman has to keep wearing the dress. But it's a strange one, particularly in the sense of, and we talk about the more adult nature of Raw going forward. References such as, it was almost like the "she was mine before she was yours" thing with the Dakota.
She's mine. She's mine. Love child, and it was so good.
That's the thing. So we clearly, you know, we've hit that adult phase now. Let's say.
It's going to get more adult with this story.
Absolutely. It's only going to get worse or better, I suppose, depending on your prerogative from here. But it was strange because the way Marlena just sort of brazenly then just accepts the match. Almost seemingly for no reason, just because a heel said something outlandish.
He said he'd retire if he lost.
Yeah.
So that was the
He'd leave the WWF forever if Goldust could beat him, but in exchange it would be he gets Marlena. And obviously, as it was going to turn out, the whole idea was Marlena wanted to be with Pillman anyway, and that was the whole idea.
Yeah, unfortunately, real life events being what they are.
The Patriot beats Vader on this episode of Raw as well. Vader attacks him after the match, and then goes through the Vader bomb before Bret Hart comes and buries the Patriot under the Canadian flag instead. So Vader gets pissed off and attacks Bret Hart and turns babyface. So, I don't know. Why ask why? The main event of the show is Taker and Mankind, there's an unlikely team for you, against Shawn Michaels and Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Shawn Michaels with some rather great chair shots to The Undertaker. Taker blades to set up the match at Ground Zero coming up. Shawn's a fully fledged heel after this match.
At the time, and even now when you watch back, even knowing what we know going forward from this point, it still seems so strange to me to see it. It's such an it seems like such an ill-fitting pairing, the sort of the flamboyant, you know, obnoxious, over-the-top character of Sean, and then you've got, you know, prissy Hunter Hearst Helmsley with him trying to be like Sean almost, and it just not, it's not coming through at all. It just doesn't come through the camera.
Blatantly, he's just hanging on the coattails of Shawn Michaels, really. And it, even when Sean leaves, going way ahead of the timeline, it still doesn't feel quite right. He doesn't really get what Triple H's character will eventually be, at least till freaking like late 99, I guess. You know, it's just forever.
I think watching this back as well, it's how ambiguous their relationship is. Although Sean, you know, to us was being overtly heel, he was still getting the girly reaction.
Oh yeah, he still did that promo, "You're with me or against me, make a choice," and he's still high fiving people coming out.
So this kind of ambiguous relationship with Triple H and Rude and China. Yeah, it's not as in your face as you'd expect. It's a slower turn. So
yeah. And as much as we all say Triple H is riding his coattails, and he absolutely is, I was not sad to see the end of the snob gimmick. It was fucking tired and played out. I hated that thing.
Oh yeah. Well, we talked about the Patriot being an ill fit for this time period in the direction of the company. The snooty aristocrat is certainly in the same ballpark as well.
Ratings for this week's battle: Nitro does a 4. To Raw's 3.1. So both numbers are both up here.
That's big.
We're moving in a positive direction for both companies, even though there is still a 0.9 gap, as there was last week.
But they've broken the aforementioned 3.0 barrier.
They have indeed.
God, it's almost like I'm clairvoyant.
The WWF is bringing back drug testing for a combination of reasons. Among them, everyone's doing drugs.
Bulldog.
There was a scare on an airplane recently with Hawk passing out. We move to August 21st, the Clash of the Champions, the last ever WCW Clash of the Champions, after the Savage and Hall versus Luger and Page main event. Sting's in the rafters with the NWO celebrating in the ring. With him was a buzzard. We mentioned this previously.
This is so bullshit.
The idea was that they would ask Sting what he wanted, the buzzard would fly from the rafters to the ring as the lights in the building were turned off, and the buzzard would have a note that said, "Hogan's soul." Somewhere in the buzzard's trek, the note fell out of his clutches, and he wound up just standing on the ropes with a group of NWO guys in the ring, trying to outwardly avoid laughing and crying at the screw up with several minutes left to kill and nothing to do on live television. So that's what you get, folks. Everyone's just kind of standing there.
I should try and catch the bird up in Great TV. Yes. Big game chasing them.
Yeah. Bagwell after it.
Get the Benny Hill music in the background.
A couple of title changes. Mongo wins the US title in the real low point of that championship. And Alex Wright beats Ultimo Dragon for the TV title, Carl. Your thoughts on Das Wunderkind?
We should have got rid of the TV title.
At the Clash, there was a bomb threat called into Nashville on the Flair match, and Kevin Nash was joking after the show that Anderson must have called it in because he was trying to convince management that someone actually cared about Ric Flair. The heat between the Horsemen and NWO is legit to a point that it's getting silly, says Dave Meltzer. More on this very shortly. Austin is out for 2 months minimum, and it is expected he'll have to vacate both belts. So that's your federally mandated Steve Austin update for the week. There will be no Raw for the next 2 weeks due to the US Open tennis tournament. So despite the fact that Raw's getting some traction here and getting some good ratings, takes a back seat to Pete Sampras or whoever the tennis player of the day is. I'm not a tennis guy, so
it still would have been Pete Sampras.
So WCW goes unopposed for 2 weeks here. August 25th, Arn Anderson retires and gives Kurt Hennig his spot. Fantastic promo here. Flair's crying in the background. Just an awesome moment. I can see everybody bowing up to the microphones wanting to talk about this.
It's kind of like I'm gonna sound like a complete mark. The whole thing with like the spot, which obviously the NWO absolutely parodied to oblivion. I bought that. I kind of fully bought that. Just in the world, kayfabe or reality, whatever. All the sense about the pride that he had within the position of being, you know, Ric Flair's right hand man, being, you know, the enforcer and so on. What kind of annoys me, which we'll get into later, is obviously what happens with Kurt Hennig. When Kurt Hennig was the right man for the job. I mean, the only other one would have been Benoit, but Benoit can't talk for shit. So it's like Kurt Hennig obviously has history with Ric Flair. Anybody who's been watching wrestling knows that Kurt Hennig's got history with Flair. So it makes sense that he's the enforcer. And so when looking at this, it's the right fit. It's the right way to go. Surely they can't fuck this up. Pride that Arn has when he just says, like, "I'm not just giving you a spot, I'm giving you my spot. It's not like Benoit or Mongo. You're getting a spot in the nucleus of the group, which was him and Ric Flair, no matter whatever. And that's what the significance of the my spot that the NWO just buried to shit, because it was significant. I love the promo. I love how they kind of like how they pull it across, and it kind of shows like, because even though like the Four Horsemen were heels for the majority of their time beforehand, there's like an honor amongst thieves kind of thing going on amongst them, which the NWO did not have, which puts the NWO over as being more heelish by the fact that they're just a bunch of hyenas, weasels, whatever you want to call them, that they're just kind of like just climbing almost over each other to try and get in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And try and go think, well, these guys were honorable thieves that respected
a brotherhood
that respected each other and honoured each other. And I completely buy into that dynamic of the promo and just how Flair just in the background, I buy into Flair babyface so much. And it's just like him crying in the background. It's just like when Ric Flair gets emotional, which is a lot of the time, I just buy into it so much more, because it's kind of that thing like when you're looking at Kevin Nash where it looks like he doesn't look like he gives a fuck what happens. It's that
what,
kind
Kev?
Of thing. Yeah, it's kind of that thing like Flair, he cares about absolutely everything. So for me personally, I care about it because Flair cares about it so much.
Maybe the law of diminishing returns though. Imagine if you did see Kevin Nash cry. This guy cares.
But it is a great moment if you can look at it in isolation. It's in the Carolinas, it's South Carolina, so it helps play into the mystique and everything that the Horsemen meant to the Carolinas. To me, it's that nice contrast of playing up the history of the business, almost the tradition of the business, and it's that tradition versus the NWO
tradition fights.
Yeah, and I always feel like that's something that they, it's hard to argue with the numbers and what they and the money they drew during this period of time, but I always felt like that was something they needed to make more of in the contrast of tradition versus this new age of selfish pricks. Basically it's one of the rare occasions where Flair gets emotional and I don't roll my eyes.
Also on this Nitro, J.J. Dillon said that he was going to sign Hogan versus Sting by the end of the year. Bischoff said it would never happen, and Sting comes out with a Hogan t-shirt and shoves it in Bischoff's mouth. So the tease for Sting and Hogan is now it's now on. They're hitting it pretty hard, it couldn't be more obvious. The unopposed Nitro does a 5.0! The show peaked during a 5.8 rating for, of all things, Eddie Guerrero versus Steve McMichael and a Mysterio versus Conan Angle, breaking the all-time quarter-hour cable wrestling audience record of 4.1 million homes set for the Hogan-Flair WCW title match on a Clash of Champions in 1994. Take that, Flair and Hogan. Guerrero did better than you. Yeah.
Those fucking vanilla midgets.
Yeah, yeah. Kevin Sullivan returns to booking in equal power with Terry Taylor on this night after being gone for quite some time.
Too many roosters in the hen house now.
WCW signs Perry Saturn from ECW for $100,000 a year. WCW has contacted numerous ECW guys with offers way over what one would logically believe their market value is, considering what guys with similar or a lot more talent that are already over in WCW are actually earning. So the influence of Paul Lee and ECW after the second pay-per-view that's just happened is prevalent here. We move now to the September 1st Nitro. It's another 3-hour show, unopposed. It's the show where they dedicate it to Arn Anderson after he'd retired last week, and of course we get the NWO Horseman parody sketch.
When watching that parody of everyone, I think actually Mongo's the one that gets off lightly compared to everyone else. You know, like they absolutely do a number on Arn and Rick. And like, you know, Bagwell's ripping into Kurt Hennig.
He does. He has
the ponytail and little else.
Well, yeah, and he's all taking a bit of the way he pronounces spot and stuff like that, you know. And then they kind of like bury Benoit by the fact that they didn't even bother having anyone to impersonate him. So
well,
like...
the original idea was that they were going to have a mannequin out there dressed as Benoit.
Oh my God.
And they got it mixed.
I'm conflicted by this because it's like, I both like... I'm annoyed by it, the fact that obviously that they're ripping into Arn Anderson and something that I generally had like an emotion with due to, as I said, the honor amongst these and so on. But at the same time, it is funny, and like it's mainly just Sean just doing the whole crying thing with the freaking gimmick of the
strutting.
The strutting and crying.
Oh, God.
And just the overall just appearance of Nash with the makeup on and the belly, and just talking about, you know, like when he's giving birth and so on. And
same fat boy's been chasing the orphan for 20 years.
Yeah, you know, and just like, was it average looks, average skills, average speed, then average quickness, average carpentry skills? Just like this, he just absolutely goes on this monologue of burying, which I fucking both hate but also find funny, because like Nash has some sort of endearing quality to him where you think he's an absolute dick, but you're just glad he's not pointing it towards you, basically, you know, and just like trying to bury you, so you just laugh along with him.
I'm kind of like the polar opposite to those 2 points, because I have no problem with it as like it's wrestling, so get over yourselves. But at the same time, be entertaining when they're supposed to be the heels. Yeah. That's what's kind of offensive about it, and it's counterproductive, and it comes from that overriding thing of where they always kind of wanted to downplay the Horsemen, like from a political point of view anyway.
And I think this is like when we talked about the NWO, and I believe we've done a podcast on the NWO, which everyone should listen to. We have to be funny, we have to be cool, we have to be baby faces, even though we're supposed to be heels. I think that's where the problem with the NWO began. All the other things are viable options, but I think it's the fact that they just couldn't be heels.
But at the same time, they were selling a shitload of t-shirts.
Yeah.
So is the answer maybe the company should have reacted and reworked the angle, but like a reevaluation of the actual program, the angle, to kind of cater for that?
We can bemoan the unprofessional nature, if you like, of the click. To Kieran's point there, the company embraced that notion. It, you know, long before the arm parody, long before then, they're just basically trying to play, you know, cool characters, and they're not overly concerned with being out and out heels. In that the NWO was never designed, in Bischoff's mind, to be a storyline or just a faction for a storyline. It was supposed to be its own entity, and eventually, in his sort of idealistic world, its own company. Maybe that's why he wasn't concerned with making them out and out heels. Fans in theory aren't going to want to watch that, so you know, it's more of a reason for them to just embrace the cool edginess.
Originally, the finish of the skit was going to have the Horsemen run out and totally clean house on the NWO. Before the show started, Terry Taylor was told by Bischoff to nix the Horsemen comeback and not let them do the running, which is believed to have come at the suggestion of Kevin Nash. Later in the show, Ric Flair was supposed to do an interview instead, but by this time Flair was so mad he refused to go on. Anderson wasn't as mad immediately after the skit, but was said to be furious later that night, winding up in a confrontation with Kevin Sullivan after calling home and finding out how upset his wife and son were. There were even reports that Anderson wound up so mad he was thinking of quitting the company.
And that was my big issue with the angle. You know, if you're not going to do the running, you've got to hammer the point home that they aren't there. Of course, how do you do that on a show that's built around a tribute to Arn? It's very difficult, I appreciate that. But, you know, to not at least have some sort of storyline explanation for why the Horsemen don't go out, I think that to me anyway, is damaging and a black eye for the segment.
The unopposed Nitro this week is a 4.7, so a slight drop from the previous week, but still a very impressive number unopposed. The first episode of the new Thursday show will be on January 7th from Daytona Beach. While nothing is certain, it appears that Nitro will be the NWO show, and the Thursday show will focus on WCW history and tradition. So to your point previously, Carl, about the NWO, that is still obviously the idea. There are no plans right now regarding the great Sasuke returning. Taka Michinoku, however, has been offered a contract, but hasn't yet signed, so pretty much swiped that from under him, didn't he?
Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Shortly before the end of this week, the four brawl main event was changed to the Horsemen versus the NWO to fit the storyline that they did last week. So yeah, when they did the Horsemen sketch, they actually weren't planning on doing NWO versus Horsemen at four brawl at all. They were just doing it just to do it. The change was mid-week, stemming from the strong reaction both positively and negatively. The fact it wasn't something planned out in advance is confirmed by the fact that Benoit was booked on the New Japan tour, and neither he nor New Japan were informed he would be delayed a week because WCW was going to need him to stay for the pay-per-view. The original idea was Luger, Flair, DDP and Hennig against Hall, Nash, Savage and Six. That was the original plan.
So yeah, that just kind of goes into obviously just the kind of the nature of that piss take promo.
That's part of the reason probably why
there was
so
no angle in it at all. It was just them being
so from Flair's perspective, yeah, it is just that, what the fuck are you doing this for? Yeah. Bullshit. We move to that Sunday, September 7th, WWF Ground Zero in your house. 4,963 fans in the building, a 0.45 buy rate, pretty shitty number there, for 130,000 buys, but because of the price increase we mentioned previously, where this is $30, just like the other shows, for a 3-hour show, a big increase on what the In Your House series used to do. Steve Austin gives Jim Ross the stunner on this show, so this is the beginning of Austin stunnering non-wrestlers, which is just absolutely fantastic. Bret Hart beats the Patriot by submission in the championship match, breaks the flag and then chokes him with it, which is pretty much the end of the Patriots as a key player. And Taker versus Michaels is the main event, the non-finish, to set up Hell in a Cell the following month. Meltzer says Austin's mic work and performance in this angle, along with the Shawn Michaels performance in the main event, pretty well stole the show. So not too much to add to that show, other than unless anybody wants to mention the triple threat match on this show, which is absolutely
no
fuck
no. Moving on.
What was the triple threat?
Savio Crush and Farouk, who
oh,
is
no, fuck that, then.
Who is the one true gang leader, I suppose, won by Savio.
No, no. Oh,
on September 8th, before Raw starts, Vince McMahon and Bret Hart have a meeting where McMahon seriously approached Hart about his contract. About 3 months ago, McMahon had told Hart that the company was in bad financial straits and they may have to defer some of the money in his contract until later on during the period. This time, his approach was more point blank. He wanted to cut Hart's regular salary, which is about $30,000 per week, in half, and defer the money until later in the contract, when hopefully the company will be in better shape financially. Bret Hart declined the suggestion because he didn't want to risk not getting the money in the future. In case you don't know where this is going, folks, this is the beginning.
The way that sounds, that does not make Bret look good.
What, that he doesn't want to get
it? Why?
But, I understand what you're saying from the perspective of the company's in a bad way.
Yeah.
He's not doing what's best for the company.
Yeah.
Bret Hart's thinking
that's what he's always thought. That's always how he's always played himself off.
On the flip side, I can see Bret's concern in the sense of they're telling him we're in bad financial shape. The deal you signed with us and turned down $3 million per year on the other side, we're not going to give you any of that now. So sorry for that deal we made. We're going to break the deal.
From Bret's perspective, sorry, just to jump in quickly. From Bret's perspective, although it's a long contract with the WWF and there is significant money involved, and I'm sure Bret wouldn't have starved by taking the initial pay cut, loyalty's always mattered to Bret. And the fact that he turned down the bigger offer to stay with the company, in many respects, you can imagine from his perspective, they're reneging on a deal signed in good faith. I've got absolutely no qualms at all with Bret Hart sitting there and saying, no, we've agreed a deal, and I've pledged to stay at a time where you needed me to stay. I expect you to honour it.
There's also like a prestige element to it as well. If you know, he sees himself as the marquee guy,
highest paid guy in the company.
Yeah, you value me that.
Drove Sean nuts.
Exactly. You'll you're paid higher. You're gonna get your money's worth and be treated like that. So massive other overtones to it as well.
Oh hey, don't get me wrong. I'm on Team Bret all the way. And always have been, but it's just the way that little segment just sounded.
No, you're right.
It sounds along that thing of that lines about Bret's always said, like he just always wanted to help the company, he's always connected to the company, and then Vince always turned around saying that Bret was always about himself and didn't really give a damn about the company. The way that little phrasing sounded, it kind of puts in the favour of Vince, where it just seems like Bret really wasn't budging on anything and wasn't making things easy for Vince when, you know, it's Vince's company, he's the one struggling for money, and Bret's not budging an inch. The way that makes it sound, it's kind of putting it in favour of Vince.
It's a tough one, both sides of the fence here. Obviously, that's what makes it such an interesting topic. But
should Bret, with hindsight, I say okay, but I want more than you originally were going to give me. So maybe that $15,000 per week with interest.
Raw and Nitro that night, let's get to it. September the 8th, Steve Austin stunned Sergeant Slaughter next, and he's going after Vince McMahon until he was pulled away. This is a great angle here. Steve Austin, again, you talked about it, Austin not being able to wrestle, but the crowd is absolutely loving him here, and this is just great.
And a surprisingly good sell for the stunner from such a fat man.
He does that here, he flips those legs out and gets it in the air really well.
Yeah, Slaughter knows how to bump for
a big guy,
matches in his youth.
As I was saying, they're setting up the thing with Vince already. Oh, yeah. It's just the momentum he's getting off. Yeah, they are getting white hot for him already.
Yeah. Also on the show, the Brian Pillman Triple X Files debuts. I don't know if anyone wants to jump in particularly on it. I mean, this was just absolutely stunning at the time. And I remember when we got the Pillman DVD in 2006 and I was watching it for the first time and Kieran's dad was downstairs, just happened to be watching, walking by as the Pillman Triple X Files section came up. And I remember he looked at me and goes, I remember that. Dad remembered the Triple X Files of Ryan Pillman vividly. I know.
That's the one where he's like, it's just shot in the
The motel room.
And he's got like the towel on as well, yeah. Like the towel drops, he's wearing like fucking pants.
There's a series of them.
Full of innuendo. They are fucking brilliant.
Some light S&M, sweeping and mopping. Fucking Brian Pillman's in his element here. He's so great. Savio Vega, the king of the triple threat match, goes up against the Patriot and Triple H in what Meltzer calls an awful triangle match main event. The British Bulldog has his knee attacked by Shawn Michaels to build to one night only. Originally, Bulldog was supposed to do the match and win when Rick Rude would interfere, helping the Bulldog beat Helmsley, showing that Rick Rude works for whoever pays the premium to get him away from Michaels and Helmsley, since Michaels didn't want him anyway. But Michaels then had the entire thing nixed and Triple H just won. So there you go. Over on Nitro, Hulk Hogan challenged Sting again, but Sting wasn't there. They are doing an angle where there is a mole in WCW letting the NWO know when Sting isn't around so Hogan can make the challenges. A mannequin dressed as Sting fell from the ceiling and crashed on the floor. Hogan and Bischoff and the EMTs went saying it wasn't supposed to happen before it was revealed it's all at work. It's a mannequin. Hogan leg drops the mannequin. Bischoff's got a ref shirt on and counts the pin. This is fucking hard watching this back.
It's just weird to watch. As I said, when the mannequin's coming down, you know there's something weird. Obviously, there's the retrospective connotation that we all probably avoid at the moment with Owen Hart. It's just one of those kind of like segments, really. I mean, if you take it out of context of obviously what happens in the other company down the line, it's the gutless heel mocking the babyface when they know he's not in the building, and you want to see the babyface there to kick his ass. But it's just as you said it yourself, Liam, when we were watching that particular segment back the other day, and just Hogan's posing at the end of it, and just looking at him going, this guy thinks he's so cool and he's such a fucking dick. He's just a dick.
It's like he doesn't actually realise that he comes off like the most out of touch fucking moron in the world, but it works for him in a way that works completely differently from what he's intended, but it works anyway.
Well, I say, while a lot of the other NWO members are trying to be cool and being entertaining, but at least Hogan is a douchebag heel doing it, and it works.
So that chicken shit heel.
Yeah, it's like one redeeming feature of the group kind of thing.
Roddy Piper is announced as the new chairman of WCW on this show, and there's a pretty wacky promo.
That's a great promo. I'll make Tyson look like a vegetarian. It's great.
Yeah, basically, he announces that he's going to wrestle Hogan in the cage at Halloween Havoc.
He announces three things.
One of which is that he's going to wrestle Hogan in the cage at Halloween Havoc. He announces it is going to be the Horseman against the NWO, and that Luger and Page are being taken out because they got their conflict. And I can't even remember what the third one is.
That he's going to guarantee the contract signing between Hogan and Sting.
Yeah, he said Hogan and Sting will happen before the end of the year. He echoes the same thing Dylan said. Luger versus DDP is the main event, and it didn't do well in the ratings at all, which is the third week in a row that Luger's segment has been down. The quick title change back seems to have done massive damage to Luger's ratings drawing power. So
there's a great Ric Flair promo in this.
The rebuttal.
The rebuttal to the arm burial, where they all come out to the ring, the Horsemen, and they're basically demanding that the NWO or the four knobheads come down to fight them. And it's just a great little promo. They all do their little bits, you know, and Henning has his say.
I will say, just before you get to Flair, Henning's shtick in this is just pathetic to me.
It's very early 90s, that the dirty end of the stick or something.
Dog doing on a stick.
If anybody knows one thing about Kurt Hennings, that I can land in the dog do and not get any on me.
I think he's still in early 90s WWF mode, I think, in terms of some of that dialogue. Mongo says some stuff. gets booed almost out of the building.
It's in Green Bay, which is key to note. He's just standing there in his fucking Bears jacket. Yeah. And the crowd boos. He just said, "Shut up, pack of fans."
Yeah. It's the babyface promo, and they're booing him as soon as he goes on the mic. Then Benoit tries to say something from the English language, and then it goes over to Rick, right? And the great thing about Rick is all of them are doing their promos. Flair is just standing there with his arms crossed. He ain't selling shit. Even when the crowd are wooing when they mention his name, he just kind of looks off to the side. He ain't selling shit. He ain't performing. He goes, later on when you get down in your career, you know, popular, maybe, I can't guarantee it. You know, good, can't guarantee it. But if you can end your career and say you can get at least one friend out of this, and you can see he's getting like emotional, he's not blinking, so you can tell if he blinks he's gonna start like bawling, and he's just looking at it absolutely intensely saying, if you can get out of this business with one friend, that's winning a title in itself.
Arn Anderson was my best friend.
Arn Anderson, he's not just a legend, he wasn't not just a human being, but he was a man. I underline man, he was a great man. And it's just like the passion he says it with, I was getting emotional again watching it, where I was just thinking like, yeah, I'm with you, Flair. I'll kick fucking Conan's ass. Anyone kick Conan's ass? And, you know, it's just like, I'll go in the cage with you and help you out. You just feel like it means so much to him.
That means a lot to him too.
I know. Well, he needs all the help he can get. But you know, he's got Mongo with him. Absolutely superb work by Ric Flair.
Flag, I can talk.
Yeah. And after all that, where they say they're not going to leave, what happens?
It's a commercial break. They come back and they've left.
And there you go. The air's let out of the room.
They did do a match later in the show, and Flair and Hennig beat Bagwell and Conan. So they did that today. Again, they let the Horsemen shine on this show. After 2 weeks of Raw going on Friday nights and doing the Friday night's main event deal and Nitro being unopposed, this is, of course, head-to-head on September 8th. The ratings are Nitro doing a 4.3 to Raw's 2.15.
Oh, shit.
Fucking evisceration here from WCW. More than a 2-point lead. Even more staggering, the Nitro replay's first 38 minutes went head-to-head with Raw's final 38 minutes, and Nitro beat it with a 2.7 to Raw's 2.2. So the Nitro replay beat the first run Raw, so that's fucking horrific for WWF.
Not 3.0 is easy come, easy go, I suppose.
Well, it doesn't put Savio Vega, the Patriot, and Triple H in a main event triple threat match. It sucks dick.
Oh, you get what you deserve.
Yep. Right now, the WWF has indicated it will drug test individuals, but it's not random drug testing as much as testing based on rumours and or supposed behaviour. Only one wrestler has been tested thus far, which would be Brian Pillman. Doesn't mention it here, but it would be. That Sunday, September 14th, WCW's Fall Brawl. 11,939 fans sell out the building. A 0.53 buy rate for 150,000 buys. That's what happens when you don't advertise your fucking main event until the day before. Because it wasn't until Saturday night they announced that the NWO members were Nash, Waltman, Bagwell, and Conan. They actually kept it vague and just said the NWO. They even said we don't know who's going to be in the match because they wanted people to believe that Hogan might be part of the match. Of course, the main thing here is Kurt Hennig turns heel on the Horsemen, joins the New World Order. The plan all along was for Hennig to join the NWO. He was originally supposed to turn on Paige back at Bash at the Beach, but they held it off because they thought there was some more mileage in the Hennig Flair story. But Hennig goes heel here. Flair is actually, the reason this happens is because Flair's going to take a couple of months off and have cosmetic surgery. So that's the reason why they did the angle, to get Flair out of the way.
On his teeth?
His face. It's facelift. Yeah, he had a facelift.
Fucking hell, that didn't work out for the best, did it? It's like a fucking scrotum now.
Obviously, it doesn't seem like the most logical move. Obviously, everybody's kind of hankering. But again, when you look at Kurt Hennig's babyface efforts on that Nitro, it's like, I've never liked Mr. Perfect in the WF as a babyface. I never liked Kurt Hennig as a babyface. There just didn't seem to be that much to get into. The casting of him in the Horseman, based on the emotion of the Arn Anderson thing, is great in isolation. But again, when you're left with the fallout of Hennig as a babyface, he isn't that. He's a natural heel. If we were going to do what we did before for the face heel show, everybody around this table would say heel. By, I don't think anyone would bat an eyelid.
The circumstances being what they are, if Flair's taking time off, this is the way you have to go. But there's still that sort of that tinge of disappointment with me, that the whole parody, and obviously, as you say, it was never meant to be. It was never leading to a match anyway, so I suppose that was why it's panned out this way. But for it all to just be swept away by the fallout of Fall Brawl is something that I just creatively, from my perspective, I find it disappointing. There's more mileage to it.
I think for me, it's just at this point, he turns and he joins the NWO. Did he need to join the NWO to be able to have a feud of Flair?
No, this is one of the ones that felt like, okay, we're getting a little bit thick here with everybody. Exactly. Every babyface that gets traction turns, it's like, ah, oh, come on. September 15th on Nitro, one day later, we open with a still shot of Ric Flair with tubes up his nose and marks all over his face as if he'd been half killed the night before, which is obviously taken from his surgery that he'd had. Tony Schiavone, citing it was Flair who got him into the pro wrestling business, was so upset he walked off the set and left the show to Mike Tenay and Larry Zbysko. Meltzer says this is one of the weakest Nitros in forever, with the main event being Kurt Hennig beating Mongo McMichael for the US title.
Well, there are some silver linings to Hennig turning heel so quickly.
Steven Regal also returns after the charges are dropped, so that's what happens to Regal pissing on the flight attendant. Over on Raw, however, Steve Austin continues his tour and stuns Jerry Lawler.
Ace.
This is when he gets the restraining order from Owen Hart, the one you can't come within 100 feet of Owen Hart anymore because he kept attacking him. And Lawler's like looking over his shoulder trying to get a shot of the contract, and Lawler gives, and Austin gives him the stunner, which is just...
And Jerry as well, because up to this point, after stunning JR and Sarge, King's total pro Austin, saying wanting him to stun Vince. So like, it's just a great. It's, and then he stuns him, like, stuns the King, and from this point, Austin's a son of a bitch as well. Yeah. So it's great.
Yeah, oh yeah, that plays in the next week as well when Lawless goes off on a tirade. But also on the show, Shawn Michaels did an interview in tight biker shorts with with socks stuffed in his crotch for whatever reason, and proceeded to make some very lewd gyrations as if he was humping Jim Ross. Everything was able to be edited off the show, and if you didn't know about the incident, you wouldn't even know the interview was heavily edited. The Undertaker wasn't there in the building, but since he was on tape on the video wall, people thought he was, and Shawn Michaels Live kept insulting him, called him a big chicken shit, and begged him to come out, and called him more names when he didn't come out. It made Undertaker look very bad in the city, not to mention it being completely unprofessional.
Ah,
oh,
Sean.
Sean.
He wouldn't have done that.
Sean.
Yeah.
He's just pushing the buttons. The tape show, he's going to do what he wants. This is the thing where he gets like fined 10 grand, right?
But according to Sean, this is where they decide that they're going to go with that attitude.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Hogan's contract expires at the end of the year, and he's already sent feelers to Titan Sports about returning for a big run. The general belief is that Hogan has no intention of actually going to the WWF, but he's using it as leverage to get a better WCW deal. Hogan is also back attempting to get Ed Leslie back in.
Oh, fuck off.
Yeah, he talked about Arn Anderson being a right-hand man. Term would apply to Ed Leslie quite literally. Expect far more WWF international tours as the company needs to establish new revenue streams overseas as cash flow is getting very tight. A bit of foreboding there for what's going to happen next week. September 20th, Saturday night, WWF One Night Only in Birmingham, England. What a show. 11,000 fans sell out the NEC Arena. I was one of them, of course, as I mentioned before on the show. Shawn Michaels wins the European title. Of course, this is a last-minute decision because Shawn Michaels and Vince McMahon have a meeting, and that's just the outcome.
Yeah, but come on, it was fucking ace.
It was great.
You watch that now, goddamn! What the super heel? He's amazing.
I loved it at the time. He's a complete dick. Obviously, the idea that they sell Davey Boy on is that they're coming back in '98 in Manchester, in his hometown, and they want to do a rematch or get the belt back. But I don't know why they would go with Shawn Michaels holding the belt again. But he never drops him anyway, and he's acting like a complete arsehole one week earlier with a fucking biker shorts deal with the Undertaker. So I don't know. He's getting away with a lot here, Shawn. Really is. For some reason, the vivid memory of Shawn Michaels just on the outside of the ring, looking at himself on the Titantron and thrusting.
It's
a fucking guy.
I try to remember. Is it like in the Bret Hart book where he talks about like that night and how gutted Bulldog?
Oh,
was.
But yeah, it's
not just because of losing the title, but the fact like
he dedicated the match to his sister who was dying of
cancer,
of cancer, and the reason that they'd made a point of that prior to the show is because Davey Boy was supposed to be going over.
Yeah.
Dedicated to his dying sister, loses in his home country and gets eviscerated so Sean can get a lot of heat.
Yeah, but the heat.
The heat's
the
great.
Heat!
It is great.
Come on.
It is great.
Arms in the air as Triple H picks him up and he's being pelted with shit.
Beer bottles are being thrown.
Oh, that's amazing.
It is great. It's quite the sight to see. We move to two nights later, Nitro and Raw, September 22nd, Nitro. A rookie Bill Goldberg pins Hugh Morris in 2 minutes, 24 seconds with a suplex after kicking out of the moonsault. Goldberg, who looked very much like Wardlord, slightly gassed down, is someone they've been high on for a few months. He definitely has potential because he's pretty mobile for a big guy and obviously green. Gene Oakland tried to interview Goldberg, who walked off. The gimmick they are trying to do is that he's a mystery guy and no one knows anything about him. So there you go, Goldberg debuts. Victory number one.
That's one.
That's one. That's what he says, isn't it? That's
yeah,
one. Which, and they didn't know they were going to do the streak at this time, but it's a very good little line there.
Prophetic.
That's one. Very prophetic indeed. However, on the other side, September 22nd on Raw, it's in Madison Square Garden. We get a very cool opening montage here where you get like all the history of wrestling, of the WWF anyway, Madison Square Garden, showing Hogan, Backlund, Billy Graham, Pedro Morales, some more recent stuff in MSG like Bret Hart's return. Very quickly, Kieran, because I know you want to mention this, Rocky Maivia versus Ahmed Johnson. Ahmed's back at this show in the Intercontinental Title Tournament and beats Rocky with a Pearl River Plunge.
Not only is Rocky nuclear over as a heel, it's the first time he's called The Rock.
Is it?
Vince accidentally, I think, calls him The Rock. In exchange where he calls him The Rock and then calls Ahmed Rocky Johnson.
Oh, I remember that. I remember that vividly.
But he calls him The Rock and I reckon he heard it back and thought... Or someone heard it back and said, yeah, let's go with that.
And it's in Madison Square Garden. Yeah. Yeah. Home of The Rock.
Ahmed looks fucking terrible in this match, by the way.
Yeah.
Absolutely
he'll
awful.
Look worse later
and he gets injured again during
the match. He does! He gets injured again during the match. And Jerry Lawler on commentary won't shut up about how he's injury prone. It's like, are you trying to kill his career?
Yeah.
Of course, the big thing here on this show, I can't believe I haven't mentioned it this far. Steve Austin stuns Vince McMahon.
Fucking ace. Oh,
which is God. Just speaks for itself. Everybody knows the angle.
It's the culmination of the stunners on non-wrestlers and
yeah.
How better to peak than an MSG on the boss.
Yeah. It's a great dynamic because you've got JR and King on commentary who've been stunned in the previous month. And you got Lawler scream at how he's going to be fired, and he should be fired, and he should go to prison. He's a son of a bitch. And Jim Ross is like, I'm not a fan of him attacking non-wrestlers at all. And like, it's like no one's on his side, but everyone in the crowd is on his side. Everyone. And people are just shitting themselves when he stuns Vince. It's fucking great. I mean, they cuff him again. He does the same thing he does from Canadian Stampede, where he's got his hands behind his back and he flips Vince off in the ring, and the crowd's just going fucking crazy. It's like, this guy is there. He's there. Yeah,
they mention it in the documentary, the Stone Cold documentary, the Vince McMahon cell.
Oh, the neck twitch.
Oh, it's hideous. But this is sort of, to me, whilst there's always been that sort of, there's always been that anti-establishment element to Austin, obviously, even up to this point, I think this is the point where they sort of really focus it, though, you know, Austin against the machine, as it were. Because obviously Vince talks in the promo prior to about working within the system and things of that nature, that sort of that corporate speak, if you will. I think this is the point where they really sort of, they focus on it, and that's now going to be the driving point.
You got it in contrast to Brett and Sean, who've been the previous two big faces as well, where they're both whiny little bitches.
Yeah.
And Austin, he's not going to whine. He's going to kick some ass and be the man. It's fucking great. Yeah.
Also on the show, Cactus Jack makes his first appearance in the WWF, beating Triple H in a street fight. Really good match here.
Yeah, they do that weird promo beforehand where it's Dude Love interviewing Mankind. Gets a pretty big freaking pop from the Madison Square Garden crowd. Triple H sells it really well, to his credit, and as you said, they have like a really good kind of match. It's one of my favorite, probably one of my top five favorites of Mick Foley's pile driver through the table.
Yeah, which coming after the Austin injury not long ago, surprisingly they went with that. But
yeah, it's funny how there's no justice in the world. Look what happens to Austin and Triple H is unscathed.
But yeah, that's just a great match. I just love the bit, the angle at the promo at the beginning with the three guys and just the match itself. I just a big highlight of that show.
I just remember being so jarring to go back to what we were talking about with Austin and Vince, where it's just like watching this show and just this whole show in general, between Cactus Jack's return and Austin stunning Vince, and just thinking, man, my mind is blown. The duo's just going in a completely different direction. I don't know where it's going, but I want to be along for the ride. It's just a fascinating show. Bret Hart versus Goldust is the main event that nobody remembers from this show. Sean and crew runs in. The Anvil makes his long-awaited return.
Yeah.
Raw does a 2.3 this week. So again, the number fucking eats it. It's Nitro's 3.7. So there you go.
And just those overall numbers of the two are dropping again from that 7.1 that was like from
what's the date there again? Sorry.
September 22nd.
Football season.
Yeah.
Mm.
But in very big news, behind the scenes at that Raw, Vince McMahon told Bret Hart at Raw they were going to intentionally breach his contract because they couldn't afford his deal. Vince told a shocked Hart that he should go to WCW and make whatever deal he could with them. Bret has an escape clause built into his contract since he had so much negotiating leverage, in that he could leave the company giving 30 days notice and he would have what the contract calls reasonable creative control of his character during that period, so he can't be unreasonably buried on the way out. McMahon, showing he was serious, gave Bret written permission to begin negotiating with WCW.
Damn.
It's just weird. It's just weird. It's one thing turning around and saying, look, we're not financially secure enough to pay this contract that you signed, but then to actively turn around and say, I think you should go to the other team.
Yeah, but that was the intent. There's only one intention to breach, because what is going to happen?
The psychology of what Vince is trying to do here is so interesting to me. Vince is trying to force him out. It looks so much like Vince is trying to force him out completely.
The signs for that are there the moment they decide that they're going to turn Sean heel.
But to me, isn't that the weirdest thing? The seeds of Bret's ending are when he wins the world championship at SummerSlam.
You said they're already taking loans out. He's unsure if they try to downscale the deal to afford him, and in their mind they just couldn't afford him anymore and in the position. So ruthless business, I guess so.
But man, it's such a weird deal.
Yeah.
That same day, during a meeting with Hart, Michaels and McMahon, Shawn Michaels told both of them point blank that he won't do any jobs for anyone in the WWF. Word that, when it got out, made most of the other top wrestlers feel even more warmly than usual about Shawn Michaels.
Unless you're one hot mama, Sean don't lay down for nobody.
Well, of course he doesn't, but don't you think it's funny that Bret's the one getting pushed out the door while Sean is saying, fuck you, I'm not losing.
Yeah, but what's Sean making at this point?
It's 750.
Compared to Bret's
1.5.
So there you go. It's, you know, it's a harsh business decision, losing Sean, because he wanted Bret to be on the money that Sean's on, so that's a figure in their mind they could afford. getting rid of Sean doesn't alleviate the problem, because you still got Brett making 1.5. So,
and it's worth remembering at this point, obviously, you mentioned about the sort of the psyche or the psychology of Vince at this stage. He's got buyer's remorse. He clearly feels like he was forced into the Brett deal against his own volition, whereas with Sean, that's a deal that they came to amicably at the time, or certainly more so than Brett's contract. So obviously, Vince's mind being what it is, and we've talked about how much of a crazy son of a bitch he is, you can just imagine that resentment festering, and that's why it's Brett that he's pushing out the door. In addition to the, obviously, the dollars and cents is the be-all, end-all, but you can imagine that playing a bit of a part as well.
But the other elements, or maybe he's thinking, okay, we can afford Sean, maybe if Brett's gone, Sean's not envious of the money, maybe Sean calms down a bit, maybe there's an element of we're going to change direction and Brett
move away from Brett.
Brett doesn't fit into that edgy, aggressive, non-PG direction more. Different elements, but I think it's probably just money, to be honest.
Yeah, we'll get more into this as we wrap up. But September 29th, it's the final Raw and Nitro of this quarter. Flair does a phone interview and said he wants to break up the Horsemen, and told Benoit and McMichael to go their own way, and said what happened at Four Brawl was his wake-up call. To show how much the left hand knows what the right hand is doing, the booking committee just had promos cut for all sorts of shows, with the Horsemen managed by Arn against the NWO for early November. So, again, you got a question. Yeah, as much as some long-term planning is there, there's not too much long-term planning going on here. Giant versus Kurt Hennig is the main event of this show, with an NWO running and Sting making the save.
Man, they're really going with Hennig this month, at least.
They paid quite a bit to get him. They put him on a good deal. He's a bit, yeah, well, yeah, he got the US belt from Mongo. They went with him as like a key guy on pay-per-view. Over on Raw September 29th, Shawn Michaels and Triple H played total smartasses and basically didn't acknowledge or put over Rick Rude, who was standing right there with them.
You know who they did put over? Austin. It's not putting over, but it's the referencing of Austin, and it's that already, you know, when he's not on screen, we all talk about him.
Yeah.
Everyone wants a piece of that shine, and yep, really stood out to me. He's like, Jesus, Shawn Michaels and talking about fucking Steve Austin in the opening segment when Austin's enough to do them. It's very interesting.
And Triple H knew how to glom even then.
Yeah. Farooq beat Ahmed Johnson to face Owen Hart in the Intercontinental Tournament final at Bad Blood. The original plan was for Ahmed to win this match, but he tore both a tendon and some nerves in his hand on the previous week's show against The Rock, when his hand hit the announce table, if you remember that, and his hand's bleeding all over the place. It hit an exposed nail and needed surgery. So there you go, Ahmed, shockingly, is injured once more.
The man's made of fucking glass.
He just can't catch a break.
Oh, he can.
Yeah, just go back to the early part of that Raw. Just Rick Rude just comes across as just a really weird fit. And not just in terms of, like, obviously the fact that Shawn and Triple H didn't want him there, but just in terms of just the fact that Rick Rude is like the third wheel in that act. If you're ignoring China. I just remember Rude being mute and just being in the corner,
standing there
holding a briefcase. And it's like, okay, that's all right for China, but someone of Rude's like caliber just being wallpaper in the background of these two is just a bit.
He hadn't been associated weird. Tightly with them, though. He'd done promos on his own.
Yeah.
When he talked about being an insurance salesman.
Yeah. Including stuff. Coming out to his old music on that specific one that you're talking about. Yeah.
So, I mean, he'd done a few, but he'd done none in association with those guys yet.
Yeah, well, they were still doing the thing of, I'm only working for who pays me, pretty much. Yeah, so he was just kind of just there.
Yeah.
It's just for me, it's just a weird use of Rick Rude about that.
But again, how much use are you really going to put on Rude when you don't have him on a written deal?
Vince confronts Steve Austin on the show and gives him three choices. You have to get a doctor's release, sign a waiver, or be fired. It's up to you.
Is this the show when he leaves to the crowd? And he's got Austin's in the riot gear, and he takes off the helmet and stun zone. And Austin jumps into the crowd, and the other riot police try and chase him, but the crowd swarm and stop him getting to Austin.
That's right.
It's like he's the man of the people already. It's fucking awesome.
Ratings. Nitro does a 4.0, back up to its high point there, and Raw is a 2.7, so it's getting a little bit of traction back, but still nothing really massively significant. Final note here for this period of time from the observers is that it appears that Hogan's booking idea is to do another run with Ric Flair in singles to lead to his babyface turn next year, which obviously is end up happening in 1999, but the plan apparently is formed here at the end of 1997. Man, what a fascinating quote, as they all have been as we've analysed this series. To me, obviously you've got the story of Austin's rise over this period of time, but to me, one that, and it's the one that's obviously going to get a lot of attention in the next quarter, is this quarter started with the absolute peak of the US-Canada feud. And by this point, Brett's been shoved out the door. It's just such, and there's more bad news to come for the Hart Foundation, obviously, as we start October. In 3 months, he's gone from the hottest heel and the focus character on the show to just, we're going to get rid of him.
Yeah, he's become an also-ran. You only have to look at the pay-per-views that follow the title win. As you say, it all stems from the fifth title win at SummerSlam. The following month, he's got, you know, ground zero in a penultimate match on the card against the Patriot.
The Patriot, yeah.
Who's got no momentum whatsoever apart from a fluke win, and that's how it was addressed on Raw, as a fluke win on against Brett a few weeks earlier. Following up with, and I don't think we've got to it yet, but we've got the Bad Blood match.
Yeah.
Which is the flag match against you got the absolute stone cold Patriot.
No.
You've got the still incredibly cold Patriot and the at best lukewarm Vader.
Conversely, on the WCW side, for as much flack as they've taken, I think this quarter is actually kind of, yeah, there's a lot of people saying that, yeah, the NWO is getting the heat. Mm. But when you look at these papers we've talked about for the last 6 months, it's like DDP winning at Spring Stampede, Flair, Piper and Green winning at Slamboree. You've had Luger beating Hogan at almost every turn, with the exception of Hog Wild, and sure, that pretty much killed Luger off. But there are shining moments here where WCW are getting to look good. It's not like it's a complete whitewash anymore. And they've got their direction.
Yeah, but at the same time, those little bits here and there, you can start to see cracks.
The cracks have been there for months.
The cracks which are gonna start coming a little bit more obvious and more pronounced as we move closer to 98 and onwards. I think you could see it here in 97, which is supposed to be one of their best years.
The floors are always there. As Liam said, I think they've got still the strong direction they're sticking to with Sting, and a couple of high points for the faces. So it's a lot more of an even keel, and it probably bears out in the ratings as well.
Hopefully they'll be able to get Sting over at Starrcade, and they won't fuck that up.
But even like to the point of like other stuff on WCW, which stuff we haven't mentioned, the Eddie Chavo feud, which was a slow burn that went over the course of several weeks. The Jeff Jarrett thing, which was paid off during this quarter, we haven't mentioned because no one really gave $2 about it, to be quite honest. But
what about Disco Inferno's title win?
Yeah, I'm not going to mention that either.
Okay.
But yeah, so you've got Raven week by week. Is he joining? Is he not? The Kurt Hennig thing's gone this whole period of time. There's a lot of stuff going on here that's. It's not all hot shot the way it was in the previous quarter.
Those issues bubbling under the surface, you're right to say that, G. And I think it's the first time, despite the fluctuation in WWF's numbers and sort of the build of momentum they appeared to have had, that they lost just as quickly, I think it's the first time where we've come out of one of these podcasts where both companies have that sort of bigger picture direction. Even with the Bret Hart issues, even with the Hogan issues and Nash and what have you, it's the first time where both companies have a sort of a clear goal and a clear path in mind.
Although, yeah, in terms of the WWF booking direction, it isn't like Hogan Sting at Starrcade.
No, it's not a strong.
But what there is, there's an identity to the show again now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really, that it's really strong now. From that identity, from that feeling, it would grow.
The next timeline that we do, there's going to be a lot of controversy. There's some tragedy in there too. It's a weird time, and you got Hogan and Sting coming up. There's a lot of interesting stuff. So we will revisit the timeline in the future. But next week's show, we will not be doing a timeline show. We'll be reverting back to our booking.
That's right, Nick Davis. Drop me a Twitter at Wrestling Profit, and as I promise, we're going to deliver. He wanted fantasy booking, we're going to give it to you.
Absolutely. We've done Saving WCW in October 99 before. This time, we are going to take the WWF in 2002, right after WrestleMania 18, the brand extension. How are we going to do it? Are we going to try and make it better? Are we going to try and turn things around? Are we going to be able to stop the downward slide that the WWF's been on since the fall of the invasion in WrestleMania 17? Tune in next week and find out. But of course, we would always love your feedback, and I'll post it on the forums. But obviously, like I said before, Facebook people, like us on Facebook. You can drop us your comments on there as well for what you would have done in March of 2002 going forward with the brand extension. So there's going to be a lot to talk about next week as we try and tackle Raw and SmackDown as it goes into this new era. Facebook.com/SCG Radio. Give us a like on there. Thank you very much for listening. For G. John Chase.
Remember, folks, next time you're fed up with a 3-hour Raw, take a massive dump in a paper bag and mail it to Lex Luger.
For Carl Jones.
Please all go out and buy my soon-to-be bestseller, We're Not Fucking Enough Rats, The Trials and Tribulations of Smoky Mountain Wrestling.
Oh, that was a great podcast, Cornette. And for Kieran O'Rourke. There's not much to say other than Kenny King, I don't tell you how to wave your dick in front of people's faces and try and talk to me about the wrestling business. That was Jim Cornette. I am Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here.